Today, as I suggested to you earlier, we have an interesting visitor, a guest in the studio. He's listed under an accurate picture, sort of, in the paper, as Daniel Groda. He's called himself Dan Groda. Dan, what would you prefer to be called?
Just Dan.
Dan, okay. Yeah. Dan has been a columnist, and I suggest an independent columnist. He's not on the staff of the Frontiersman as such. He's been invited as a guest to provide his perspective on the world. And how long have you been writing columns for the Frontiersman?
About a year and a half now.
Oh, okay. It seems almost like it's been longer, because I have been reading your columns.
Yeah, I could be off on that, but let's see. The first one was like June, not last year, okay. Probably about almost 2 years, maybe.
Okay, somewhere in there.
I'm a little bit off on my calendar type stuff sometimes.
Right, and I know that you have had an interesting background. You had to, because you served, 21 years in the Army?
Yeah, 21 good years in the Army. Okay. I had a break of 5 years, so technically if I stayed in longer, it would have been close to 30.
Wow. When did you retire?
July of 2006.
Okay, that's not so long ago.
Yeah, but I went in August of 1980.
Oh, okay. and I mentioned to Dan that I had to have served, only I almost hate to use the numbers, because I was way back in the Vietnam era.
Okay.
And 5 years of regular Air Force and 1 year in the Air National Guard.
So right on.
Had an interesting. In fact, had an opportunity to serve in a mixed unit that included Army, Navy, and Air Force. So that's a rare thing.
That is a very rare thing. I never heard of it happening before. But
and so in so doing, maybe there'll be some things that I'm aware of that we can share. But I'm more interested in starting out by. The question, what prompted you to, were you approaching, did you approach Frontiersmen? They approached you?
They approached me. What started off, I started writing as a way of compensating for my PTSD.
Okay.
When I retired from the Army and then retired from the shop down at the CSMS shop down at Fort Rich, I was working as a technician for the Alaska National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
When I retired from there, I really had no direction. I really couldn't do the work I wanted to do because of some health problems.
Okay.
And my PTSD, one of the symptoms was my hands shook.
Okay.
Uncontrollably. And I'm also an artist on the side, so I couldn't control my hand. But I could do the typing.
Oh.
So I started to do posting comments on the Seattle Times, which I got boosted from. Don't ask me why, but okay. Hey, it's a okay. Sort of a, I call it a trophy mark there.
Okay.
But I started posting comments on the Frontiersman, ironically, in the religious section, the faith section. And after a while, Heather Rios, the editor, contacted me via email saying, I really like your comments. I really like the way you say things. Would you like to be a columnist? So I said, after about 5 minutes, actually probably about 5 seconds of thinking about it, yes. And I started off... in the Spectrum, that's the real guest columnist column.
Right.
But they gave me my own byline, and they took a picture of my ugly mug and put it on there. And then after a while, she contacted me again and said, well, you've been on here a while, and you're almost pretty much a regular. I was doing it like once or twice a week, which is basically what I've been doing now.
Right.
And she asked me, you got your own column now. Think of a name for it. And that's how I came up with the name, Front and Center.
Front and Center, yeah.
I gave her a list of potentials, and she liked that one, and I liked that one, so we went with it.
Okay.
And I've been doing the Front and Center column for quite a while now, and I'm also do the Valley Voices, which is a Sunday piece, and that's split between three of us writers.
Okay.
Chuck Legge,
right.
Charles Hayes, and myself.
Okay. Three. By the way, you three are quite a triumvirate. I know Charles very well. Each one of you has your own perspective. And
yes.
We've had Charles, of course, here in the studio. So now we've done. Now we have you. And hopefully we can bring Chuck in one day, and we'll have covered everyone. But the three of you have your own interesting style. How would you say you developed your style of writing?
I'm a voracious reader. Voracious.
Okay.
I have a collection of 3,000 plus books. Most of them are in storage, but I've got several hundred at home, so I'm well insulated.
Okay. And that seems to be a very common trait, that the two things that seem to produce good writing over time is both writing, just mm-hmm. the pure act of writing, as well as reading. They seem to go hand in hand.
Yeah. It seems to. A lot of the best writers were voracious readers themselves. My favorites are like H.G. Wells and Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov, along with Frank Herbert of Dune fame.
Okay, yeah, I've been there. iRobot and beyond. So this column that you do has what I would suggest a certain style. I mean, whether you're Julie O'Malley or Charles Hayes or you mm-hmm. or whoever, there, Gail Collins, throw a few the other big names out there. You fall into having a style which is, however, not a rut, because one of the things that I noticed about good columnists that I like to read and read regularly mm-hmm. is that they have an ability to surprise, so that it's not as if I'm reading a comfortable repetition of something that's said over and over again. And each mm-hmm. time I read that column, I come away and I say, there's something here that was different that piqued my interest, my curiosity, moved me a little bit. And I detect that in your columns.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's like sitting down here. Mm-hmm. And having a conversation.
Okay.
And that's how I try to approach it in my writing style. I'm sitting down. I'm having a conversation with a reader. Sometimes I'll start it off with a question. Did you know? Or why is this? And in today's column, I wrote on how I was upset about certain people and their views about the president during the Inauguration Day events.
Mm-hmm.
And how they... how do I put it? Okay. They were posting pictures on my Facebook page. I got a Facebook. Everyone has
sure.
a Facebook page.
Right.
Everyone and their brother has one now. And they were posting pictures of the president with Hitler. Pictures of Hitler next to him and captions saying something either that Hitler said or they compared him to him. And I just got really upset by that. Mm-hmm. There's no sitting president in the U.S. history that comes even close to the evil of that madman mm-hmm. did in his reign of terror. Mm-hmm. And to compare the sitting president of the United States to that megalomaniac is, well, as I put it, sickening.
Right. Well, let me just take a quick break for the top of the hour. This is KVRF Sutton, 89.5 on your FM dial, Big Cabbage Radio. And we're in the midst of an interview with Dan Grota, who is a columnist with the Frontiersman. And we're talking about his column in today's paper entitled, No U.S. Presidents Have Come Close to the Evil of Hitler, Stalin. You know, that's an interesting point to make, and I'm suspicious that very often, and I might share your reaction, someone who makes a comparison that's sort of over the top hasn't done a thorough study mm-hmm. Of whether, in this case, it would be Hitler or Stalin. Even a small look at the two would realize what they.
It'd be like 30 seconds comparison. There is no real compare. I've been to Germany. I've been stationed in Germany twice.
Sure.
And I've talked to people from both sides of the war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from British officers to a German NCO who was in Schweinfurt on the receiving end of the Black Thursday Schweinfurt raids.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen the result of what Hitler did to that country and a good chunk of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama, yeah, he has faults. Everyone has faults. There's no perfect person on the planet, especially a U.S. president. Mm-hmm. They do make mistakes.
Sure.
You know, and I supported them in the election, and that was the first time I ever publicly did that. And I found that some of these people are my friends. I respect their right to say that, but I also have a right to say no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the First Amendment, it's a two-way sword.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I wrote that column.
Okay.
A lot of times when I write pieces, it'll be on something I really feel passionate about, or being a veteran, it'll be on veterans' issues, or sometimes it'll be on something amusing, like, you know, running into the moose at 3 o'clock in the morning trying to get the newspaper in the middle, you know, like that.
So you write these columns, and you've written this one today, and in fact you reference the fact that you check your Facebook postings. That's part of what prompted the column. Over the past year and a half, 2 years that you've been writing this, my suspicion, you have been able see responses. What kind of responses do you get to your writing, like, overall? What's the...
In person, generally, people I've run into like them.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes on the comment sections in the Frontiersman, so a lot of people like them. And then again, on certain subjects, a lot of people don't.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very vocal and upfront about their comments, you know, and about how they dislike certain issues I take up. And sometimes they can be amusing. Sometimes they can be rather upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I write the opinions not to be liked by everybody. I write these pieces so people can converse about it, talk about it, bring it up. You know, he brought this up. Get the conversation going.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that sparks something. Maybe it'll spark someone to go volunteer for help out the homeless, or help out, you know, a homeless veteran.
Sure.
Or to take up the issue of debate the issue. I've done quite a few pieces on gay rights and gay marriage.
Right.
I'm all for it. And some people get rather upset about that. And then some people have said, you know, maybe you ought to shut up. And I just say, no, I'm not going to shut up, and I'm not going away.
All right. Okay. Well, I know that very often in this today's world, whether at the national level or even in Juneau and locally, that whole question of how to engage people in discussion so that it's not just hiding behind a wall, throwing a stone or something else at the other person, it has been the subject of a lot of attention. How to make it better so that you can actually sit down and come up with sharing of points of view, and not just say, "Well, I don't care what you say." And as soon as I hear that, I
that's the one reason why I try to bring up. Trying to get the conversation going, which a lot of times they do. They hide behind a wall and they throw bricks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to listen to you. And they get this vitriol going.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets toxic.
Sure.
And it's part of the major problem here in the U.S. with how everything has gotten polarized to the point where nothing gets accomplished. If you're going to bring up a subject, you better be willing to discuss it as adults. And be aware that someone's not going to have your same point of view.
Right.
But have the respect to listen to that other one's point of view. And that's why I have so many friends on the Facebook that are diametrically opposed from me, but yet we get along because we're willing to discuss things as an adult and with reason, and also to allow the other person his or her say and be willing to discuss the finer point of things. That's how everything in this, at least in this government, how things work.
Sure. And it's maybe the first sign that you have a way of communicating with someone if two people can say, well, you know, I disagree on this with you. I have a different point of view, but I also agree on this one. So that they can actually do that rather than, you know, demonizing or characterizing the other person as all bad. You're either with me or against me, and that means you're with me or against me in everything that we ever talk about.
That's
probably the hint right there.
When they start throwing up labels like you're a liberal Democrat, and I say, no, I'm not a liberal Democrat. I'm a moderate and an independent. I'm not a label. I'm a person. Mm. So maybe we disagree on, you know, gay marriage, but you probably like my taste in Led Zeppelin or something like that. Oh. We find a common ground.
Sure.
And then go at it from there. Sure. And that seems to work a lot for me in my life. You know, Find common ground with people, whether it's in books or art or music or, you know, bringing up the kids or having the family dog chew up the family photograph in the middle of Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you're with that kind of thing. It's interesting. So obviously this was a major event that occurred recently, the inauguration. I was privileged to be able to travel to Washington, not this year, but 4 years ago. I can tell you that I did this because we had some friends who live in the city. We were able to stay with them, and because it seemed to be going, when I checked with them, and they've lived there in Washington for many years, and they've seen many inaugurations, but what they were suggesting was that this one looked like it was going to be different. I have not attended a lot of inaugurations as they have, so I couldn't make that comparison. I can only say that in my experience, it was extraordinary. And as they pointed out the differences, it was like talking about tides along the shore, saying there are some tides that come in and go out, and then there are special high tides. And this was a high tide, both, I think, as measured by the number of people that were there and all the rest that went with it. It was, was there on the wall during that whole time. It was a very different thing. Yeah. Now, we come to this 4 years later, and there's been a re-election and another inauguration. It is safe to say there weren't quite as many people. There were still crowds.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was a well-attended. And I suppose that's it's different. And a lot of people attended and found it to be, just extraordinary that it was a re-election in these times. And a lot of people, as you yourself, watched it on TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First time was definitely history in the making. And even the second time in this re-election was history in the making.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time a man of color, a black man, mm-hmm. was elected to the highest office of this nation.
Right.
And growing up as I did, I was born in 61, so I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. So I got to see a lot of the changes, even though I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
Moving around the country, as we were growing up, we managed to see quite a lot. And one of the things that influenced me a lot, especially on civil rights and stuff like that, was when we moved to Louisiana. During the first year of desegregation, this was the year Martin Luther King was shot. This was the year Robert Kennedy was shot. Mm-hmm. And being from the East Coast, Massachusetts, and then coming from California, I'm half Portuguese, so we tan really dark. And moving to Louisiana with Yankee accents and dark skins,
mm-hmm.
we ran into the worst of what people can do to people. Just judging people on the color of their skin, I saw white-only signs, black-only signs. Mm-hmm. They were still up. My sisters got kicked out of a theater because it was a white-only theater, and they thought my sisters were mulatto, half black, half white. And we actually had a run-in with the Ku Klux Klan, a friendly one. They threatened to bring crosses in our lawn because little old me wanted to have a birthday party with all my friends from my school.
Sure.
All my friends were black. And we lived on an all-white golf course. We didn't know it at the time that it was an all-white golf course until our neighbors called the friendly clan to pay us a friendly visit with a business card. They gave my mom the card, and it said, "You just had a friendly visit from the Ku Klux Klan." Flipped it over. Said, "Would you like to have another one?" And they were implying they were going to bring crosses in our yard and everything else. We left that state in less than 3 months.
Mm.
That stuck with me. really stuck with me. I really don't like prejudice. I really don't like people judging people on how they look or how what color clothing they wear or where they come from. Or, you know, Steve has a boyfriend named Joe. Mm-hmm. Or Josephine is, you know, dating Julia. Mm-hmm. And it all dovetails.
Sure, sure.
And to see this, to see, you know, Barack Obama become president was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing. And to see him get reelected, that was amazing.
Okay.
People were giving him odds. You know, I think a lot of people lost some good money on their bets.
Well, I was following Nate Silver, who was doing a particularly good job of pointing out the accuracy of some polls and inaccuracy of others.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, in all the time, you served in the military, in the Army, during a time of evolution as well.
Yes.
What did, throughout that period of time, did you notice about changing attitudes toward different groups of people in the Army?
Oh, wow. When I went in in August of 1980, Jimmy Carter was still president, mm-hmm. and this was during the Iran hostage crisis, too.
I remember it well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I went to basic training in Fort McClellan. I learned my job, my MOS, as we mm-hmm. call it, to work on Huey helicopters in Fort Rucker.
Okay.
My first duty station was in Germany, Schweinfurt.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that was a time. And this was still... the Vietnam era veterans were still in.
Mm-hmm.
They were still in positions of command, but also the era of there was a lot of drug and alcohol abuse back then.
Sure.
It was rampant all over the place. You couldn't, you know, throw a rock without hitting some guy smoking a hash pipe over there.
Mm-hmm.
And things gradually started coming around where in the early days from like 80 to 84, people was, you know, getting drunk and stoned and getting real stupid. And even though I was over there during the Cold War, it wasn't really taken too seriously. So things started changing around when they started doing the drug testing and started weeding out all the druggies and stuff like that. I'm no saint. No, I did a lot of that stuff, too. That was the culture.
Mm-hmm.
But we still, when it came down to doing the job, we did our jobs. And it was on the off time we got, well,
sure,
idiotic. But there were definitely cliques back then. You had the country boys hanging out with the country boys. You had what we call the brothers doing their thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you had me. I was one of the rock and rollers. So I was. If you go into the barracks, you can hear, go down one section, you hear all country music in three rooms. Go two doors down, and
right.
You hear R&B and soul coming out of those doors. Go down some more, and you hear Led Zeppelin cranked up to the nines.
Okay.
But things started integrating a lot better after around 84, 85. And I got out for, I think in 83, I went into reserves for about a year, and then went back into the active army. And by then, things had changed. It got more professional, more serious.
Mm-hmm.
And things got more integrated. There was still some divides, but we started learning, you know, you have to get along. And I remember back at that time, I think it was my dad got remarried to someone in Texas. And I went down to their place down in Weslaco. And her brother was asking me, well, what do you like at the Army? You know, I like doing this and all that stuff. And, well, what do you feel about working with them? And he used the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very calm
mm-hmm.
and very quiet. And I said, well, I work with a guy who's a direct descendant of Buffalo Soldiers. He's blacker than pitch, meaner than a snake, and I love him to death. And I would serve with him.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere he wanted me, I would do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you better rephrase that. And he just sort of shut up and just walked off.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So you've paid, that's an interesting picture. My time in the military was preceded yours, mm-hmm. although I did serve in Germany as well, at Wiesbaden.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah. I was reflecting on this, too. It was Vietnam era, so things were all in the process of happening. It was... So I saw a military that was getting ready to evolve, getting ready to move into the 60s kind of drug culture, et cetera, that not only prevailed in the military, but also in the United States and mm-hmm. the society at large.
Yes.
And I think that's an important point to make is that what happened, you know, the military has interestingly enough, sometimes been ahead,
yes.
sometimes, you know, in leading the country in certain directions and it's also been a reflection of the society at large.
Yes, it has been.
Depending on
U.S. Army, U.S. Armed Forces, especially the Army, were the first ones to integrate black and white units.
Right.
We segregated them.
Mm-hmm.
They were also the first ones to actually put whole black units starting in the Civil War.
Right.
Under white officers. And it was segregated all the way up till then to about, I think it was it Ike Eisenhower that signed it?
Yeah.
Okay. He integrated the armed forces. The Marines took a little bit longer, but we were the first ones to desegregate and work together as a team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after 85, they started getting more professional about, you know, really getting, you know, down on the mission. It was more mission-oriented. The hair, mm-hmm. which was long when I first went in, you know, people had, I had bangs down past my eyebrows. But, you know, we could
sure.
Put
right.
it up. Everyone started getting the haircuts real short.
Yeah.
And everyone started getting, the ragbags got weeded out and people really started getting mission-oriented. The Army today is far different than the Army was when I first went in.
Okay.
And I've seen a lot of changes, from uniform changes from the OD greens, like that field jacket I was wearing.
Right, right.
To the new pixelated gray stuff.
Right.
The uniforms that they're wearing now. That uniform was just coming out just as I was retiring. So I've been through the OD greens, the BDUs, the DCUs, the desert camouflage. That's what
sure.
I wore in Iraq. And, you know, just a general attitude. They still have problems. No one's perfect. But it's definitely a definite change from the days when I first went in at 19 to the days when I retired at, mm-hmm. you know, what, 46, 47, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, here's the other question, of course.
Oh, boy.
Recently, Leon Panetta, as issued an order at the advice of the chiefs of staff that have essentially allowed women mm-hmm. to be involved in combat in ways that they it's an interesting situation because, as you know, many women have been in combat,
yes,
you know, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, but to allow them to participate in units where they had been prohibited from participating in the past. What's your read on all that?
I'm all for it. I think it's high time
mm-hmm.
that they get recognized for their service in those combat roles that they've been thrust into,
mm-hmm.
sometimes involuntarily. There are, in Iraq and Afghanistan, there are no front lines. Let's get that out of the way right off the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
They're on bases. The second you step off that base, what we call cross going over the wire,
mm-hmm.
outside the wire, you're in a combat zone. You're a target.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyone that goes outside there is in the middle of it, male or female. They don't care.
Mm-hmm.
You're just wearing a U.S. Army, U.S. Armed Forces uniform. They're going to go after you. From what I read on, I went to the Stars and Stripes recently because I had a conversation about this with a friend of mine who's he just got out on a medical thing. He was infantry his entire career, and he did about 10-15 years before he got retired medically. And Panetta said, apparently, it'll be at battalion and company level, and there's talk about opening up some at least from what I can gather, they might be loading up some combat arms MOSs. Now, those brigade and those battalion and company level jobs are in, like, combat infantry or support or whatnot, where normally women could not work because they were considered combat arms. And combat arms MOSs were male-oriented, male strictly male.
Sure.
I hold one. I hold three MOSs, and one of them was 13 Foxtrot, which was Field Artillery FO, Port Observer, and that's male only. If this thing evolves with the way I think it has evolved, more women might be allowed to actually go into these MOSs and serve. They're just as capable of serving and fighting, just like their male counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done excellent jobs. You know, in Iraq, we had... my engineer unit was basically all male, but there was females in there too, serving as medics, serving as construction engineers on, you know, heavy equipment, and they served right alongside the guys, and it worked. When we got to Iraq, my unit got busted up and scattered all over the Middle East, and my section out of 50, I was a maintenance section, I was a mechanic, got knocked down from 50 to 18, and eight of us were mechanics, responsible for an entire brigade's worth of equipment. And we did a pretty good job, but we also had medics with us, and there were two males and the rest were all female. And at first the command balked at letting them go outside the wire to do their thing. And we told them, and we passed it on, you know, to my commanders and all that stuff, that these female medics served with these guys, know how they react, know them well, and these guys trust them. And the male medics were getting burned out.
Sure.
And next thing you know, they're going out on missions with them. They're going with the QRF, the Quick Reaction Force. They're going out with the scouts. They're going out with the command group. And we were responsible for the perimeter around LSA Anaconda, which was a huge base. And the 81st Brigade that I was with was responsible for that. We took over from the 82nd Airborne. They did a fantastic job. And some of those women, even as tiny as some of them were, none of us guys would want to mess with an M16 in our hand. They were that good. And they got our respect.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because you're a guy that's been there. And my suspicion is that we've been talking about the evolution of a military force, and I think it continues to change and adapt for a whole variety of reasons. Partly changes in the whole culture, partly because of changed mission. And it'll be interesting to see how that moves along. Well, Dan, this has been fascinating, and I'm going to hope that you'll be back again.
We're running down toward
the bottom of the hour. We've had a great discussion, and I know listeners may want to turn to the Frontiersman today. They can to catch Dan's column. Right on the opinion page, just below a very interesting cartoon by Chuck Legge. and the best to you in continuing to write what, I'm not going to say they're provocative. I think they're original and independent perspectives on life here, both in the Valley and on topics that affect us here in the Valley from Washington, D.C. or beyond.
So, thank you.
Okay.